in my opinion, we're still so early in the space. And if you think about the problems, so like the big problem is that I kind of think from an analogy perspective, we're closest to like mid-90s internet, right? And the similarities with some differences, but the similarities are like there's millions or maybe tens of millions of users of this stuff.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unchained, your no hype resource for all things crypto. I'm your host, Laura Shin, author of The Cryptopians. I started covering crypto 8 years ago, and as a senior editor at Forbes, was the first mainstream media reporter to cover cryptocurrency full-time. This is the March 5th, 2024 episode of Unchained. Polkadot is a leading layer zero blockchain with over 2,000 developers. And the Polkadot 2.0 upgrade will be a massive accelerator for the ecosystem, making it faster, more secure, and adaptable. Perfect for GameFi and DeFi to build, grow, and scale. Join the community at polkadot.network/ecosystem/community. Hey, Unchained listeners. As you know, it's hard keeping up with the fast-paced world of crypto, so we've got just the thing for you. Subscribe to our free Unchained daily newsletter at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. You'll get the latest crypto news and original articles from our reporters, as well as summaries of other happenings and bullet points, plus our meme of the day, all curated and written by our amazing team. It's still your no-hype resource for all things crypto, just in newsletter form. Sign up at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Again, the URL is unchainedcrypto.substack.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today's guest is Alex Pack, managing partner at HackVC. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
You recently announced that HackVC raised a $150 million fund. Congratulations. And if you're announcing now, you must have raised that money in a bear market. And I'm curious what that was like, especially kind of in the post-FTX, Terra, Celsius, 3AC, et cetera world. And I know this is a multi-part question, but then also since you've been in crypto for so long, like how would you compare fundraising this time around to past fundraising efforts?
Yeah. Totally. I think you're absolutely right. The fundraising environment in later 22, 23 was more challenging than in some prior periods. I've been in crypto for 10 years. Like I started in 2014. I've been an institutional VC the whole time. So these sort of cycles of investor interest and investment interest and prices and so forth are not new to me. But, you know, every cycle comes new investors and they go through the same sort of worries and so forth. We were still oversubscribed by the end. So it wasn't terrible. But, you know, for us actually, and I'll just sort of say the reason behind the fund too, the $150 million venture fund we raised was pretty opportunistic. So it's a fund that invests alongside our existing, like we raised a $200 million vehicle in 2021. That was sort of peak bull market era. We didn't have to raise it. We did it because we wanted to double down on the opportunity in early stage Web3, which is where we focus. So now we have all the capital to deploy behind our theses. I think for us, maybe there's also a question of why not just wait a little bit until it's easier. For us, it's just very on brand to kind of raise in a bear market, sort of part of our investment approach. I think to a lot of LPs like people who invest in venture funds, we're sort of known as like the fundamental value investors in crypto VC. So we're not momentum guys. We don't even use the word narrative like in our investment team meetings. We try to ban it, narrative memes, things like that. We don't even do like NFTs, gaming, metaverse, sort of these categories that are a bit more meme-y driven. We do primarily early stage infra. We're very thesis driven. We spend most of our time researching the fundamentals, like thinking about whether it can be transformative for Web3. And that just comes from my background. I've been an institutional VC for a long time. One of my first roles in the space was at Bain Capital Ventures, where I helped build out their early crypto program. And we were one of the first like big VCP firms to even do tokens at all, which seemed crazy at the time. We were probably the first arm of a PE fund. You know, Bain has like hundreds of billions under management to do Web3 in a dedicated way at all. And then, you know, after that, I started one of the first true venture style crypto funds in Asia called Dragonfly. So for us, again, we're trying to do the fundamental research. We actually do models for a lot of our investments. And we try to invest in technologies, not just because they're cool, like that's part of it, of course, but also that they solve real problems for the industry, as opposed to maybe just science projects. And so, you know, usually a good time or pretty decent time to invest as a fundamental investor is in a bear market, right? Because it's almost definitionally true. If your job is to sort of pick underappreciated assets, back categories before they have a narrative around them, then that's like a mispricing, and mispricings are more likely, you know, these things are more likely to occur in bear markets, right? So we felt if we didn't kind of put our necks out and say, hey, like, this is probably the time that you want to be doing some fundamental style, you know, value-based investing in crypto now, as opposed to, you know, when Bitcoin was at 65K, I guess the first time Bitcoin was at 65K 2 years ago, it would be kind of off-brand for us.
But were LPs kind of asking you different kinds of questions in the post-FTX Terra Celsius 3AC world, or not really?
Well, different from past. The particulars are different. You know, the case studies like FTX blow up, Terra blow up, what is an algo stablecoin, things like that were different. But to be honest, the main questions are always, the main questions of skepticism are all pretty similar. They're like, is all of this stuff, is like crypto going to become illegal? Is it all just scams? Are there any real use cases? What are the use cases of crypto? Those are the kind of questions that have been happening for since 2014, like since I got into the space, really. And you have to explain like, okay, well, there's a few things changed. Like Ethereum came out since then, smart contracts, Bitcoin is better proof of, I mean, you know, this technology may seem very nebulous and obscure, but it actually is really impactful. It leads to more use cases and so forth. There's like a big rate of change over time. But if you're just looking at the, like the mainstream media, at least, maybe not you, but just the press headlines, you don't see the details. You just sort of see like this thing blew up and this thing crashed. And you're like, okay, well, has anything changed in the last 10 years, right?
Okay. So yeah, I mean, a lot of it, I guess, is not that different from like past type of questions, but maybe just a little bit more of them.
Well, it's flashier too. I mean, like it's sort of macabre to just, I'm pronouncing that word right, to describe, you know, FTX, the FTX blow up as flashy, but it was way more in the public conscious than when Mt. Gox blew up in 2014, right? Even though Mt. Gox actually took down, like there were way more of a percentage of the total crypto market cap was lost in like the Mt. Gox exchange hack in 2014 than in FTX, like a much larger, and you know, Bitcoin fell way more. There was no ETH at the time, but I think, right, Bitcoin fell way more at the time than it did from all-time high to trough then. But it wasn't as much in the public conscious. You didn't have this, you know, founder who was going off in Congress and everything like that to add like the flash and gruesomeness to it.
Yeah. And I have to ask you, you know, I mean, it's pretty famous now. You had this incident with Sam Bankman-Fried where he wrote a tweet thread about what he called a horror story involving a crypto VC, which was you. And I know you've talked about this incident multiple times, but I do have to ask you, now that the trial's over, his sentencing is coming up, and we're seeing crypto already in the early stages of this bull market, like, you know, it really feels like we're kind of moving past that whole period. When you look back, like, what are your takeaways? And also, did this like tiff that you had with Sam benefit you in any way when you went to raise money? I was so curious about that.
Well, it's an interesting question. When you get to I was one of the first investors to pass on investing in Sam, but I didn't like short FTX. You know, I didn't like make money on that trade. Whereas like Michael Burry, people, all the guys that you write about that were written about on like the Big Short and stuff, they actively shorted. They made a bunch of money off of the 2008 financial crisis. You can't really do that in crypto. If you try to short FTT or somehow synthetically short the FTX, you're just going to get wrecked, right? Because Sam's going to come after you and he's going to pump his own coin. You know, that's not a good move. So it's not like I don't have like this case study of like, I made all this money off of FTX or anything. It was more just avoiding catastrophes by dint of doing like a lot of diligence, you know, like my story was I kind of committed to invest with him on a handshake basis after just a couple of weeks. And it was like, for the same reason that everybody else committed to it. Like, it was like, this guy seems so smart and he's got these baggy shorts and he's so different. He's a contrarian and he's such a super genius and he's got these big ideas. He can take over the world. He's like a character out of Silicon Valley, right? He's like the ideal founder you want to back. And your first impression of him is really good. And of course, it's all like a facade, right? It's like an American Psycho first scene of, you know, he's like carefully in American Psycho, he's like trying to make himself look very good and you know, Christian Bale's character. But now in the modern day era of like Silicon Valley, back these sort of weird nerdy types, it's how do I make myself look totally disheveled? Like I just rolled out of bed, but it's still very carefully done. And so, but then we did 6 months of diligence and passed after that, which was a very long period of time. I wouldn't recommend doing that much diligence for a $2 million check. So that's like a good story. And that sort of goes along with our approach to investing, which is we try to do our homework. We try not to be very FOMO-y and sort of chase these rounds that are super hot. And, you know, the founder's like, it's closing in 2 days or something. We're like, okay, great. Have fun. So I guess in that sense, it was a story relevant to sort of our approach. But in general, it's a black mark on our industry, right? It's not a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing that, in my opinion, he's in jail and that this happened earlier than later. But of course, it's still a blemish, obviously, on our industry.
Okay. But like I did ask you also, did your tiff with him benefit you at all? I was just curious about that.
I mean, I don't know. I like to think that one of my most important takeaways from that situation was you probably just shouldn't back like sociopaths. There are a lot of them in not just our industry, but as CEOs. Like actually, sociopaths are highly overrepresented among CEOs. I don't know if it's in tech, but in all business, right? And a lot of them can make you good money, you know, like backing them. They're very ruthless. But they often throw you under the bus at the end, which is kind of what happened with Sam. So in that sense, I'm hoping that, and maybe this podcast will help, like get out the word, like, hey, like if you're like really sociopathic, just don't pitch me. Like there's other investors that will take your money. Like go to them, you know, just because then I'll, so that in that sense, I'm hoping that is helpful for, you know, my returns or whatever over time.
Okay.
We'll see
I get
how that
the
goes.
Feeling. I get the feeling that an actual sociopathic founder would be more tempted to pitch you. But anyway,
oh god.
So let's
reverse psychology, right? Yeah.
Let's talk about Hack VC. The name of your firm, I believe, comes from the fact that you guys back the hackers of the internet. It's what I've read in your materials, and you have something called Hack Labs. Why don't you, just talk about this philosophy, and then maybe explain what Hack Labs is and why you think it's important for a VC to have a team that does those kinds of things.
Totally, yeah. Hack Labs. And also the other part that it actually came from is Hack Summit. So Hack Summit is this open source developer community that we've been running, like my partner Ed too, even before crypto. It was just like a well-known open source software conference, and we did virtual conferences and we do hackathons and hacker houses. And of course, like Web3 is all open source software, right? So it lent itself very easily and we sort of pivoted smoothly into that. And that's his community. It's like 130,000 engineers, developers, people who've been to our events and conferences and things like that. And it's sort of a developer community of our own that hackers we back, right, can use to bootstrap their own developer ecosystems. So that's one. And then, the other big differentiator of our fund is Hack Labs. So we actually use the protocols that we invest in. And we built out we have a team of engineers and former quant researchers and traders and smart contract engineers, things like that. And we built out a lot of, I would guess, it's like we're an institution, so institutional grade tooling to be able to not just staking and governance, but also like participating in DeFi networks and providing liquidity. And that's very important to us. Again, we mostly just back infrastructure, whether it's DeFi, centralized financial infrastructure, or, you know, deep tech protocols. And so being able to use the protocols that we back is really helpful to us in our diligence and to actually supporting our portfolio. And then having Hack Summit as this sort of big community that they can tap into, right? Because most of them are trying to build their own developer ecosystems or communities themselves. And they could sort of latch onto ours, speak at our events, you know, do events with us, things like that. That stuff is very helpful. And then the third thing about our firm is just, I've been doing this for a while. And I don't know what the count is of how many deals I've invested in over the years. It's like many, 100 plus. So if I haven't invested in something, I probably passed on it. Like that's just a which is like a negative, but you know, so we have like a network and we have a lot of relationships and sort of advice from over the years backing unicorns previously that we can use to help our founders. And really, yeah, like just get in the weeds with them. That's the idea behind Hack VC. Like, we're hackers ourselves. We want to back hackers. Like, we want to get in the weeds with you guys as founders that we back.
And something interesting is you guys begin hosting hackathons with Zuzaloo, which is the new, or I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, the new community initiative co-founded by Vitalik Buterin and I guess one of your venture partners. So how did that idea come about and what's the goal of that?
I call it Zuzu for short, but it's not even, it's like, anyway, it's the name of the thing was so that it had no SEO whatsoever and it didn't come from anything and it was like totally agnostic of meaning. But yeah, Zuzaloo was this event that Vitalik and one of our venture partners co-founded with Vitalik and is a core organizing member of. And I just think it's very cool. It's a sort of attempt at like operationalizing Balaji's network state concepts and not starting with like, okay, let's go build a government or let's go negotiate with nation states or anything like that. But it's starting with the idea of like, how can we build a permanent hacker house or hackathon and then expand from there into maybe like a San Francisco or a college campus or something like that. So the first event was in Montenegro and it was basically a takeover of sort of a small resortish town. And there were a few hundred people there full time and then another 1,000 part time. And I don't think they wanted to do any press just because Vitalik he just doesn't really care that much, you know, but there were all these articles at the time about like, is this like the crypto Illuminati? Like everybody's meeting in this weird, like back, like, you know, rural area, all the elites in crypto or something. But the idea was just, I mean, it was amazing. Like I loved it. It was a month or two long. Yeah, it was 2 months long. There were seminars, there were themes. It wasn't just crypto either, and it definitely wasn't just Ethereum. There was a longevity track, there was an AI track, a governance track, and people would fly in for like weekends and there would be seminars. Then you would like have dinner and drink with like the person leading the seminar, right? The seminar or the or speaking at the event or something like that. So it was very, it reminded me of like my college days, right? At a liberal arts college. And yeah, there's a bunch more. There's some of them happened around Denver, around DevConnect. We like it because it's like Hack Summit. We do events anyway. Like we build developer and like builder communities anyway. So we thought it was in theme and it was like sort of a little bit of giving back too. So yeah, I think it's very interesting. I think like this whole network state and building a new community because like San Francisco is failing and there's no amazing city for being a builder or being a tech founder, let alone a crypto founder with the regulatory issues and everything else. This adjacent idea of like, hey, like maybe we should just build our own like town or country or something over time feels very crypto-y and very like free, right? And I find it personally quite fascinating, even if it doesn't totally intersect with what we do day-to-day investing.
And was there a particular goal for it or like has anything kind of more concrete come out of it?
Well, they've built, like we sponsored hackathons there and there have been some pretty cool open source public goods projects that came out of it. There's this thing called ZooPass, which they use as their like ZK-based ticketing and identity system. And I think it's really cool. There's a few other things like that that are sort of open source community building tooling that sometimes intersect crypto, sometimes don't. And what else came out of it? I mean, it was like the first time a lot of big teams in crypto met each other for the first, like it served as sort of like offsites for, I think, like big L2 projects and things like that. So the goal is always like, how do you advance the space in some way? How do you build things, right? I don't know I guess it'll take a few years to find out if it was YC successful, like if there were amazing billion-dollar teams founded there or, you know, that met there or projects that started as hackathons there. But, you know, it was pretty interesting so far, at least.
All right. So now let's talk about your new fund and I guess the other funds you have not deployed. Like when it comes to deploying all that money, what is your area of focus or what are your areas of focus?
Sure. So we're pretty thesis driven in our approach, which is a bit of a buzzword. So I can get into what that means. Generally, though, we focus on early stage Web3 infrastructure, whether it's decentralized or centralized, that's needed to take Web3 mainstream. Right. And that's kind of our big mission. Like working backwards, how do we solve the problems that make Web3 usable for, I don't know, like my grandparents or something, right? And there's a lot of sub-themes throughout that. It's changed over time. I would say some of the big ones we're looking at now are just more infrastructure to make blockchains more scalable and secure. In particular, we're very excited about sort of the Web3 AI intersection. I think that's like a whole paradigm shift waiting to happen, although it's early. And then I think DeFi is very important. I kind of view stablecoins as part of DeFi, and stablecoins are just like unambiguously the killer app of crypto outside the first one of, okay, let's like buy Bitcoin. It's like digital gold, I guess, but it's a use case, but it's a use case where you sort of just sit on it, but it's fine. But so it's like, I think the most used use case, right? Buy stablecoins, do payments, and then it's like your gateway to DeFi. So that part is still very exciting to us. And we're looking at ways to sort of in financial infrastructure to make DeFi more interactable with the real world, right? Like real world assets, make it more capital efficient. I would say those are three of the big ones we've been focusing on in the last year or two. In my opinion, we're still so early in the space. And if you think about the problems, like the big problem is that I kind of think from an analogy perspective, we're closest to like mid-90s internet, right? And the similarities with some differences, but the similarities are like there's millions or maybe tens of millions of users of this stuff. And it is truly useful to a small but growing group of people, you know, stable coins and so forth. But it's incredibly hard to use. It's slow. It's really not secure. And the security thing, by the way, we could touch on that too. That's like a huge area that I think once you solve some of the early scalability like issues in the last few years, it's really important. Like with the internet, you had viruses that were prevalent everywhere. And you had sort of even more of these more like practical security issues of like, you know, like scary predators in chat rooms. Like that was what the internet was known for. You know, you don't know who you're talking to, all this stuff, right? And in crypto, that's, you have smart contract hacks and you have scammers who are just like constantly trying to, you know, take your NFTs and stuff like that. And those are like the equivalent of, you know, in the internet era. And so, you know, my thing is like, you wouldn't let your grandma or your mom even use the internet back in the early 90s. They would log on and immediately get you a bunch of viruses, brick your computer. And you wouldn't let your grandma use MetaMask today, right? I certainly would not. I mean, that's like a minefield. And so, you know, we're trying to invest in the technology infrastructure that will change that. And it might take some time, you know, like the internet had been around for decades during the 90s. And it was still like arguably mainstream adoption didn't happen until like the mid 2000s, even maybe post like mobile phone, like post iPhone, right? So it took another 10 to 15 years for true mainstream adoption to happen. But you have to start somewhere, and it was a productive time to invest and be in the space regardless in the internet era. So
let's actually start kind of at the more cutting edge of that part of the list. You've invested a lot at the intersection of crypto and AI, and you said you believe that HackVC is actually the most active Western investor in the space. So talk a little bit about how you think these two technologies will come together.
Yeah, some of that is actually, we've done a lot. Like myself and some of my other partners have done a lot of like angel investing and prior investments, even in just general AI. So yeah, one of our big investments in a prior fund is Jasper AI. And it was one of the very first sort of applications on top of ChatGPT, and it came out before ChatGPT even came out. And now it's sort of this like enterprise grade tool for marketing teams at big companies to use generative AI. And we've even done other things that have, and so we probably backed like 30 different AI companies over the years. Quite a few of those are unicorns. But the Web3 AI intersection, I think, is super fascinating. I think generally these two things, like trends, Web3 and generative AI in particular, are probably the most important technology trends of the last century or like, you know, since 2000. And they are starting to intersect finally with Gen AI and with blockchains getting more scalable. So there's kind of two ways to think about it. There's like how, and from us as infrastructure investors, right? Like infrastructure that helps blockchain applications and dApps integrate generative AI. That's very cool. And then on the other hand, like the infrastructure that gives generative AI applications the benefits of blockchain tech and sort of how does crypto help AI, right? I don't know which one you want me to start with. I could do both.
Yeah, go ahead and start wherever you prefer.
Okay, yeah. The area where I think crypto helps AI is the most fun and active today. Like it's a real problem. So right now, the biggest problem in AI, like development and AI building, is like compute. And how do you get more GPUs? And then how do you, the inequity problem too of how do you actually get GPUs to startups and founders and developers and hackers, which is where I think most of the main innovation in the last few decades has come from, right? So, you know, the big US tech cos are hoarding GPUs like I think Meta announced in their last earnings, they have like $10 billion of H100s. And it's impossible, like it's basically impossible to get GPUs outside the US at all, even if you're a big company, right?
And wait, an H100 is like a type of GPU or?
H100 is like the best. It's like the premium GPU that you use for it from NVIDIA that you use for high-end generative AI applications, LLMs, like text to video, stuff like that. It's the gold standard. Like everyone's trying. I think they're cost like $40,000 or $50,000 a pop. And yeah, people, it's like a marker of like prestige, how if you can get one or how many you have. So they're always sold out, right? And even Sam Altman is running around trying to like allegedly trying to spend $7 trillion to like build his own, I don't know what is it, TSMC or NVIDIA comp to get more compute, right? So if it's this hard for like OpenAI and Sam to get it, he wants to spend trillions of dollars to raise from the Saudis, you know, they're like obviously like really hard for founders that we back to get this set of stuff. So I view it like the $7 trillion problem in AI. And I think crypto is actually really good at solving this. Like most of crypto is just decentralized marketplaces. I mean, Ethereum is kind of a decentralized marketplace for compute, like for CPUs. In a way, you have things like Filecoin and Arweave for file storage. And then I view a lot of DeFi as just sort of like these markets that enable like democratized access to financial products, right? So we started backing a lot of these like decentralized GPU networks. And I think these could be, you know, these are like the next Ethereums in many ways, like ways for anybody around the world to offer, and you know, Airbnb for GPUs, basically, ways for anybody around the world to offer or start provisioning GPU resources. And I think more of those sort of networks will emerge over time. Once there's more models and once more of them become open source, we could see things like decentralized, like blockchain powered networks or marketplaces for AI models, for AI agents and so forth. But compute is the very bottom of the stack, right? That's the most essential part.
And so then the idea is that basically you could decentralize compute and then there would be this like, I guess, broad democratized ownership of it or something. Is that?
Or at least access. I don't know about like ownership. I guess you could have a token and then the network is owned,
that's
but whatever.
That's what I meant by ownership token.
That's cool too. But I would say simply the Airbnb for GPUs and having it be secure, 24/7, permissionless, composable, open API, you know, all that sort of stuff, right? That's the stuff that is really impactful because like, yeah, we have, I mean, there's decentralized GPU networks today that have clients from Web 2. You know, they're not using it for even decentralized application purposes, you know, and they're not necessarily super crypto pilled, but they're just like, yeah, like I need H100 resource. I need compute, you know, and I need it 24/7. Like I need it during, you know, there might be periods where I need more of it and I need less of it. And I had to buy a bunch of them. But now like there's this period where I'm not doing any training whatsoever. So I might as well like rent out the space on it on a network. Yeah, that's very cool for startups. Cause you know, like AWS and Meta, they have a big balance sheet and they sort of get to run these marketplaces on their own, right? I mean, like Meta has tons of uses for these GPUs. They have lots of different divisions. AWS too, they could give it to other people or they could give it to like, you know, Amazon businesses, things like that. But startups, there's no way to just like easily rent out your GPU for an hour or two or access it during periods of like peak demand or something like that.
All right. So in a moment, we're going to talk a little bit more about how crypto and AI can work together. But first, a quick word from the sponsors who make this show possible. Polkadot is the largest layer zero blockchain with over 2,000 developers. And the anticipated Polkadot 2.0 upgrade will be a massive accelerator for the ecosystem. Upgrading the infrastructure with 8 times higher transaction throughput and twice as fast block times, perfectly tailored core time for the needs of every protocol, trustless bridges internally and into Ethereum, Cosmos, Near, and Binance Smart Chain, revised tokenomics and the implementation of a token burn to reduce inflation. Perfect for GameFi and DeFi to build, grow, and scale with one of the most active crypto communities in the space. Polkadot recently announced a partnership with Mythical Games, bringing top games like NFT Rivals with over 650,000 players and 43 million transactions to pave the way for GameFi and the Polkadot ecosystem. Get your Web3 ideas to market fast with economics that work for you. Think big, build bigger with Polkadot. Join the community at polkadot.network/ecosystem/community. Back to my conversation with Alex. So I also just wanted to mention that two of your investments, Ritual and Eigenlayer, they bring together crypto and AI. And I just wanted to hear you talk a little bit about your investment thesis for each and how you see that partnership between the two protocols working.
Yeah, these are kind of combining two of our themes. So I'm trying to think where to start. Ritual is awesome. I think it's kind of on the other end of the spectrum of what I was talking about. It's sort of like this middleware solution for bringing generative AI and AI agents and open source models into decentralized applications. So it's like, okay, how do you, and this is very important, I think, because the bigger problem here is like, how do you have an economic layer for AI agents? Today, AI agent, like LLM, and by the way, what is an AI agent? It's like an LLM, any old model is kind of an AI agent. It's an agent in the sense that it can execute complex tasks on behalf of users and act pretty autonomously, right? So you could think of like, okay, you, like Jasper AI is like your marketing team in a box, or you have other apps that are like your AI lawyer, your AI accountant. And so these are agents, right? They do things for you. But the problem today is that these things are very siloed and they have no financial layer. Like if you just go to the ChatGPT plugin store, which I think they even discontinued because this idea like was, it was so early and the web was like so non-composable that didn't really work. So today LLMs like can't touch money at all. They can, you can like go and be like, hey, like, can you plan a trip for me to France or something, right? And like, oh, you should maybe buy this ticket and that, but they can't actually execute any of those tasks. Now that said, maybe you don't want them to execute all of them immediately because they might hallucinate and buy you a first class seat or something, whatever. Those are like implementation details that will get solved one day. So crypto is amazing because it's a way to, you plug your AI agent into a smart contract and all of a sudden your smart contract can start buying and selling things with, or your AI agent can start buying and selling things with stable coins. It can like invest for you. It can do all sorts of crazy things. And that, I think, broadly is what Ritual, in many ways, is trying to do, right? It's sort of this middleware that makes it really easy for blockchains to, and smart dApp developers to build this stuff. Okay, great. Now there's this other problem with EigenLayer, that EigenLayer is trying to solve, which is like a lot of middleware in, and middleware is, I mean, I guess it's like in the name, but middleware is like in between applications and, you know, very low-level infrastructure. It's basically infrastructure. It's things like oracles or query layers like the graph in crypto. These things are sort of a sit in a very weird place in crypto today in that they're usually not low enough level that they need to be a whole protocol. And, you know, there's no like Chainlink L1, I guess yet, I don't know, or the graph L1 or L2 or something like that. It makes sense for them. They don't need to be that secure, but they are like essential like plumbing in the crypto industry. And they can be attacked very easily and things like that. So what EigenLayer does, EigenLayer is basically a protocol. And it's part of this sort of shared security category. There's other ones called Babylon, which we led their round recently. An alt layer, which is big in the EigenLayer ecosystem. That basically allow you to sort of restake your ETH or Bitcoin and create like a trusted, like a blockchain level security without having to roll your own POS network or you know, whatever, you do consensus, right? And so that's great because that's like EigenLayer is like an ideal solution, I think, for all sorts of middleware, oracles, like these open like decentralized databases that's sort of in the back end of a decentralized application, all sorts of things like that. And it makes a lot of sense for Ritual. It makes a lot of sense for all sorts of applications.
All right. So one other thing that is talked about quite a bit in the crypto space nowadays is the modular versus monolithic blockchain architecture debate. And HackVC is firmly on the modular side of the debate. So I wanted to hear you talk about your conviction in that. Like, why do you believe that that's the future?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm like very firmly or ideologically on one side or the other.
Okay, maybe I don't know. I read something where I got that impression.
I mean, look, people say that about us. Like we invest in a lot of modular infrastructure. It's definitely a core thesis. I find it funny though, because like kind of the first like modular investment we made was and I did this many years ago at a prior firm, was like the Cosmos and Atom, like the Cosmos ecosystem. And back then it was just like interoperability, like let's like make it easier for blockchains to talk to each other. And it's like also isn't that modularity, but it all sort of things take on narratives, right? For us, it's pretty simple. I think, yeah, modularity versus monolithic is a great way to signal two different approaches to scaling blockchains and building better user experiences for you know, people using blockchains, right? And monolithic approaches are, and the examples are typically like, I guess like open source, Google, Linux, like that, or even Microsoft on the one hand versus like Apple on the other. And the trade-offs are like, If you have a monolithic approach and you bundle all the services you need to make a blockchain really simple, you can make user experience better, and you can often composability is a little bit better, and you create like this great little walled garden, or it doesn't have to be walled garden, but this great little ecosystem that all work, everything works with each other. You don't get random errors. And that's what like using the iPhone, like iOS app store is like, right? Like no app you download is like a virus, and it usually works well with other apps and so forth. And so the big one in this space, I guess, is Solana. And like personally, I do think that using DeFi in Solana today is like a more pleasant and easy experience, because you're not dealing with all these bridges, all these like sort of sub coins. And, you know, it's like the gas is just in one. You only have to pay gas in one, in Sol, stuff like that. So today, that's the benefit of monolithic. And sorry, this is the opposite of what you asked me, but so monolithic like optimizes for today, I think. And then modularity, though, I think like a modular approach optimizes for tomorrow or 5 to 10 years out, something like that, right? And the modular thesis is like very simple. It's like we're really early in blockchain. The infrastructure is super early. It's super bad by any standards. And the most important thing is not solving for like short-term user experience benefits, but for like just get like some massive, maybe multiple big infrastructural paradigm shifts first before we start optimizing for user experience. And I do believe that. Like I think like, yes, like, you know, maybe Phantom or whatever is a little easier to use in MetaMask today, but ultimately like neither of them are anywhere close to usability for mainstream audiences. And so with modular architecture, the benefit is you get to specialize, right? And via specialization, you get optimization. And so you can solve the trilemma more easily. The trilemma is like, you know, scalability, decentralization, and security. And you can just up-level all three of them. Like you could have one blockchain that focuses, or one piece of a blockchain that focuses on scalability, one that focuses on, you know, security, you know, things like that, right? And you don't have to make these trade-offs. So then developers can, now it gets complicated for developers because they're like, well, what tech stack do I use? And it gets weirdly ideological because, you know, in nowadays you see this trend where like, you know, like a project is kind of trying to reinvigorate themselves. They've been around for years, like an application, maybe their token's not doing so great. And they're like, we just moved to Solana, or we just like started using Celestia for a data availability layer. And I'm like trying to imagine what this would be like in Web 2, where you have like an old app that's not getting much use. And they're like, guys, like we just moved to Snowflake. Like we switched from AWS to like Google Cloud. Like big press announcement, you know? But that's what blockchain, I mean, you know, they're communities and ecosystems as well as this piece of technology. So these ideologies form. But yeah, I would say from us, from a practical perspective, modularity solve, like a lot of this modular blockchain solve very practical problems. They help, you know, bring better security, better scalability, and so forth. And we like that.
So let's now talk about DeFi. As you mentioned, you have your labs where you are, you know, experimenting in DeFi. DeFi kind of had its DeFi summer, and then, you know, obviously we went through the 2022 period. Where do you see it going in this cycle? Like, what are the areas that you're focused on or find most interesting?
Yeah, for me, I started investing in DeFi like, I don't know, like many, many years ago, like several years before there was like a word for DeFi. And back then I was just saying, like, I like sort of financial applications-ish for blockchains. At this point, I think DeFi and especially stablecoins within it basically represent the biggest use case for crypto outside of like the Bitcoin store value thesis. And then the other thing is it's also sort of middleware at this point, right? Because if you sort of dig in beyond the hype of like, why would anyone one day use a blockchain-based game or a blockchain-based social network or whatever, it's because you're able to inject this financial like layer to it, and you're able to turn them into money games and, you know, reward, like all sorts of like sort of financial games and like features you're able to like build in natively into these applications. That's maybe why they're better than Web 2 games or Web 2 social products. And, you know, even ownership is part of that, right? Like ownership is like you give yourself a share of something, right? Or a token. And so I view DeFi as also essential infrastructure and plumbing for any of these other consumer applications to work. They need to plug into them, right? And that's why you saw like Stepin at one point was the biggest app on Solana by far. But it was like Stepin was the biggest user of gas. And then right behind it was Orca, because everyone was just like buying and selling these like, I don't remember what they were, shoes or something, right? And so you needed Orca. Like, Orca was the decentralized exchange. You needed Orca for it to work, right? And then eventually they're like, oh, Orca's like taking so much value. We're going to build our own Orca, whatever, right? So that's why we're pretty excited about DeFi. It's infrastructure, and it's also like the biggest use case today. And I would say the other good thing about DeFi is it kind of didn't blow up the past cycle. Like, a lot of CeFi just sort of collapsed. And DeFi, especially like, you know, Ethereum-based DeFi, that's totally open source, you didn't have any major like under-collateralization events on, you know, Compound Aave, things like that. MakerDAO didn't break their pen. And this is pretty remarkable given that, you know, there were like massive moves in the price of the volatility of these crypto assets that back this stuff. So what I think we have today in DeFi is we have this sort of pretty cool, kind of scary jungle gym, or like jungle rather, not even jungle gym, jungle, where you can, it's like there's like, it's like a carnival, but it works with like high speed roller coasters, and it's very intense, but it works really well, but it works for a very small number of use cases, like over-collateralized lending, trading crypto assets, and it's very separate from the real world. So to get that, you really just need more real world assets. Like, in many ways, stablecoins were the thing that brought DeFi to, you know, brought traction up a ton. And it sort of the opposite too, like DeFi also helped stablecoins and helped build it. And so I think we just need more real world assets. Like, that's the easiest way to sort of like see DeFi, the space, getting things like getting T-bills on chain, getting better stablecoins that are more transparent and open source and all that fun stuff. So we invest in a lot of things like that. And then the other thing I'll say is it's hard to like put stats around this, but we're definitely one of the more active institutions in DeFi today, providing TVL, you know, going in pools, being liquidity providers. And it is like really, really challenging to do it in a regulated, compliant fashion. You know, we're like in the US, we're SEC registered, we're an RIA, registered investment advisor. And so we have high standards around reporting, around audits. And we have this team of like great engineers who came from big, like, you know, prop trading firms, Meta, you know, Fang, stuff like that. And for like the first 6 to 12 months of joining us, they were basically just building like accounting infrastructure, you know. But accounting is like insane. I mean, if you ever tried to do your taxes after you do, like, because, you know, like one little thing, like provide some liquidity to this pool, ends up being 15 discrete act transactions, right? Like, do bridge to this. And then you get gas, and then there's like dust along the way, and you buy gas on this chain and that, and you bridge in all this stuff, right? So yeah, solving some of those sort of building blocks, like how do you do accounting and stuff like that, is also very important. But yeah, the juice is worth the squeeze for sure. I think it's a really essential area to spend time in, and it needs to, yeah, for it, if it improves, the whole ecosystem improves.
And you mentioned stablecoins, which obviously played a very central role in the year of 2022. You have experience investing in Maker, Terra, Liquity. What's your take on kind of where stablecoins need to go at this point? And yeah, just whether or not you think decentralized stablecoins will work at all.
So stablecoins were like it was the best of times. It was the worst of times for stablecoins. On the one hand, it was definitely the best of times because, you know, to put numbers around how well stablecoins were basically the use case that did not really fall much at all, despite the, you know, the 70-80% drops in like wealth in the space. So yeah, the high level stats, I'm sure people say this on your pod all the time, but it's like, you know, they're doing more volume a day. They're settling more volume, like or transferring or settling more dollars worth of value every day than like all the card networks, Visa, MasterCard. They're doing like 50 billion plus a day. Wow. And then the fact that like every once, like some quarters, Tether makes more in profit than BlackRock, which is like the largest asset manager and one of the largest financial service companies on earth, is just nuts. Like, if it was public and a little bit more regulated and so forth, it would be one of the largest financial service companies on earth. So yeah, to ignore this category, it would be quite stupid, I think. And to ignore interesting experiments would also be quite stupid, I think. And so what do I mean by interesting experience? On the other hand, you had situations like Terra and these algo stable coins that just grew extremely fast and then fell literally within a couple of days and caused all these issues. And so I've been investing in stable coins for many years. And I remember like back in 2017, there was a particular surge in like alignment, like ideology around like an X maxi. You know, there were Bitcoin maxis, there were ETH maxis, and there were even Bitcoin Cash maxis. That was like a big thing back then. And I used to, yeah, back in the day, old history. And I used to joke like, oh, I'm a stablecoin maxi. Like I just want stablecoins to work wherever, whether on Bitcoin or ETH or, you know, whatever, that's the most important. And I think that's played out. But yeah, there's all sorts of these experiments still happening. I think Terra was an experiment that also got muddled with a lot of fraud and was a very reckless experiment. But there's things like Athena today. There's all these sort of, you know, almost every decentralized derivative protocol.
And you didn't invest in Athena, but do you think something like that could work?
Yeah, totally. Look, I mean, I thought Terra, like an algorithmic stablecoin, could work. And I wouldn't be surprised if like a much better, sensible version of Terra does actually work over time.
So your take on Terra was that the issue was fraud?
Oh, a lot of, well, I don't know about specifically Terra. I mean, there was a lot of alleged fraud, but I would say, can I step back and give like a historical analogy? Like,
yeah,
just to make it clear. So yeah, I view all these things as basically financial experiments. Athena, we can get to it. Athena is basically doing the basis trade on ETH, but tokenized. And I think calling it a stable coin is probably a misnomer. I think it's more like a structured product or a interesting synthetic asset.
And wait, basis, you're talking about with this like early stable coin that like it was this
unrelated. Athena is like the basis trade is when it's like an arbitrage trade where you arb the funding rate and you're able to earn in a market neutral way, like maybe 10 to 20 or 30% returns. But the returns are very volatile. They depend on basically how out of whack like the derivatives markets are versus the underlying spot or markets between exchanges. And that's, so it's a very common type of trade. Like a lot of trading firms have been doing this for years. And this is basically, Athena is a way to package it and offer it to everyday users, right? Most of these things in crypto, these experiments have very clear TradFi analogies, actually. It's not just Athena. And like the basis trades worked for, now sometimes the basis trade collapses and breaks and you could trade it poorly. And that's, you know, market making trading firms blow up all the time. And it's basically the same situation as Terra. So if you were to analogize Terra to like TradFi and the, you know, the 2000 year history of finance, basically it's a decentralized central bank, and not just Terra, but algorithmic stablecoins that does three things. One, it creates this asset that is pegged to another asset. So it maintains a peg. And two, it does it without being fully collateralized. And three, it does that by basically promising shares of future profits to investors. And that's kind of what the Luna token was, like share of future seniorage. So that's like, has that ever happened before? Have there ever been some central banks that maintained a peg without being fully collateralized? Yeah, like tons of them do this. There are dozens of historical antecedents going back like centuries. So today we're not on a gold standard, so we don't do this. But for about 100 years prior to World War I, most Western nations maintained a gold standard. So that means they pegged their local currency, the franc, the pound, whatever the dollar, you know, for the US, they pegged their currency to the price of gold. But at almost no time and this was like, you know, the 1800s, early 1900s, at almost no time, practically speaking, did all of these countries at once have enough gold, like have an equal amount of gold in the reserves that they could to back their currency with. Even just the logistics of like moving all that gold around, like shipping it across continents and stuff, would have made it impractical. So what they do instead, they basically created central banks. All the central banks were basically started in this time period, this 100-year period. The Banque de France, like Bank of England, etc. And they created the central banks. And the job of the central bank was to defend the peg from attacks. And they would do this by either, sometimes they would sell shares in their banks, which are kind of the equivalent of like owning Luna or like the, you know, the equity coin or something. Or they would do government bonds. They would sell government bonds that were denominated in their own local currencies. They would like sell bonds or their own shares in their, and bonds would offer interest rates, right? So they would entice speculators or investors to go buy the bonds, and they would buy the bonds in their local currency. And so that took the currency out of circulation. And then when they would sell bonds, this would also increase the interest rate on other government bonds, like selling bonds lowers the price of the bond. And then there's an inverse relationship between the price of a bond and its yield, right? So it would increase the interest rate in this jurisdiction. And then that would encourage even more speculators to come in and buy the local currency in order to then, you know, buy government bonds and collect the high interest rate. Right. So this worked out like fine for a lot of countries and a lot of currencies for many years. But also it didn't. Like it wasn't like 100% success rate. I mean, you know, Germany, there are lots of situations of hyperinflation in this period too. yeah, it would fall apart if the central bank got the algorithm wrong of buying and selling, and or if the reserve ratio got really low. And the reserve ratio for Terra was really, really low, like, so to speak. There were, you know, there were like Bitcoin reserves, but it was like a half-hearted effort at the end. But yeah, like this high-level concept of let's have a central bank and let's give it the job of maintaining a peg by giving out like some sort of promise of future returns is fundamentally like a sound concept. And it's basically, it's almost exactly this concept of using interest rates to maintain currency pegs and influence the economy. It's like exactly what the Fed does today. It's called open market operations. They go out and they buy and sell bonds. And by doing that, they manipulate the interest rate. And they could either do that to maintain a peg if you're like a fully or moderately backed country, a Mali-backed reserve system, or you do it to like influence the economy and get you out of recession or not or something like that. So yeah, where am I going with this? Basically, there's a lot of these. I think the thing that it explains and the thing that draws me to think, you know, even things I haven't invested in like Athena, the reason I find them cool is I think it does show how powerful DeFi and the crypto-based financial system is, in the sense that like the idea that anyone can spin up their own central bank to algorithmically manage a peg, and you could create structured products to do so as well. Like also, I think the Terra model of Luna was so bad. Like it was like, yeah, they could have done bonds, they could have tranched it, they could have had an algorithm, they could trade. There's all sorts of things they could have done. But the idea that you could do this is pretty, just like in your garage or whatever in your house, is pretty cool, because the only people that could do this before were nation states. And which is to say, like, if you had a military and you had territorial sovereignty over your state, and now you can create like your own financial ecosystem without like having a military, without threats of violence, without actual use of violence. And that is pretty awesome. Like, yes, of course, like not all experiments are the same. There should for sure be regulations around this and disclosures and things like that. Even the fact that Terra was like, and I think Athena, that fact that these guys are calling themselves stable coins. I mean, I'm guessing Athena probably has a lot more disclosures than Terra did. But there's problems, of course, but it speaks to the flexibility and nuance that you can do and building complex systems in DeFi. So sorry, that was my like little professor financial history monologue.
No, I loved it. And it was, even though it was a stablecoin question, it was sort of a DeFi answer, which I thought was interesting. So earlier you talked about how security is still a major issue in crypto. And I wanted to hear kind of like how you guys are thinking about trying to invest in this area to, you know, address that issue. Cause I agree, it is such a huge issue, and crypto is not gonna go mainstream until we resolve that.
Yeah, it's really tough. There's so many hacks. There's bridge hacks, and then there's this differences between a hack and also a scam are very hard to tell sometimes. I think there's kind of two ways to think about security. There's more secure smart contracts. That's the first way. And that absolutely has to happen. So the good news is there are interesting ways to have a lot higher security guarantees that your smart contracts are good. Right now, the model of ensuring that you have secure smart contracts is just insane amounts of audits. Like we had a protocol that launched, I think it's launching now, and they literally did 7 audits. And it's just, I mean, I think it'll cost you like $1 million, right? It's insane. Like you look at, I find the crypto, by the way, crypto is like probably the highest margin like industry I've ever invested in. It's like finance meets software, and all the software is like open source, you know? So it's funny to like look at the cost structure of some of these crypto protocols. And it's basically all just audits and legal fees. Like so if you could take those out, that's great on its own. That solves that problem, the margin problem. But yeah, like this, and then doing an audit every time you want to push a V2 is also crazy, right? So you need a way to do like continuous audits and so forth. So it's not good right now. One way is you can maybe have just better programming languages. Like the EVM is basically Solidity. Which is basically JavaScript, which is like a very not like like. Rocket ships are not coded in like Solidity because they like it's easy to make a small error. So you want to have languages like Move is a very interesting one that the Meta Facebook team created. So, you know, we're investors in Sui. Aptos is also doing it. There's a lot of ideas around how you could bring the Move language to Ethereum as well, right? And get like composability there. So I think that's interesting if you get programming languages that are just much harder to like much easier to code in at the low level and much higher security guarantees in language. A formal verification as a service is also really cool. It might be like this very big brain problem that's hard to solve, but if you solve it, it's a big problem. So that's some of it. I mean, I even think we may want to have reversible blockchains under certain circumstances. And yeah, like, do all blockchains have to be fully, like, the settlement is final forever? Like, you know, with the way the optimistic rollups work is you can, like, there's a trial period and you can contest it and things like that. Maybe we roll that out to financial transactions as well, right? So I think that could be one solution. It's hard to tell though, right? And then, you know, purists hate this stuff, but again, we're trying to actually invest in tech that is not interesting to purists, but interesting to solving problems for users. So that's a lot of stuff. Then the other level is like kind of what Eigenlayer and shared security protocols are doing, which is how do you make blockchain level security cheaper and easier? And that, you know, Celestia is solving this problem. Like, what if you just have just a data availability layer, and then it could be much cheaper, and the sort of security benefits you get versus cost is like a higher ratio. That stuff is very cool too, and is also solves these problems, of course. Like when you have a lot more, when it's much harder to attack a blockchain or attack a dApp, like that benefits users at the end of the day too, right?
All right, so now let's just turn to where we are at this moment in time in crypto, because we've just had these Bitcoin ETFs approved. We're seeing that this is definitely getting us into the, I guess, early stages of the Bitcoin bull market, possibly a whole crypto bull market. We have the halving coming up. I'm just curious for your thoughts on where the markets will go in 2024 and what you think might be kind of the major tech catalysts of this bull market.
Yeah, I will say one catalyst that even took me by surprise is obviously the ETF. I would say, I was blown away by, it was exceeded my expectations. I kind of was thinking that, like, there's two benefits of the ETF, right? One is regulatory clarity, and that's good. Like, the SEC said that 11 ETFs can go out after blocking it for years. So hard to imagine that crypto and the eventual adoption of crypto into TradFi and integration of crypto into the financial system is not going to happen, or at least is going to be blocked systematically by, you know, one guy or one agency. So that was a genuinely positive, like, structural change, right? And I think a lot of us sort of saw it coming, but with the Grayscale lawsuits and even, you know, Ripple lawsuits, stuff like that. But it is very positive. It it bodes well for regulatory stuff in the US. So I was like, okay, like, even if the ETFs don't do well, still good, like, still positive, right? Fortunately, it also did really, really well, right? It, like, exceeded all expectations. I look back, I just wanted to see, like, did it actually exceed expectations, or is it just, and I saw there was, like, I think Alex Thorne came on your show a few months ago from Galaxy, and he gave what I think he's a great researcher, but he gave what I kind of thought was supposed to, like, you know, a lot of equity research analysts, they love giving, like, a really, really big number, it's big attention. So he gave, I think, like, a really huge number, and it was, like, $14 billion of inflows in the first year. And we're already at, like, 7.5 billion. Like, we're more than halfway there. So even the, like, let's go as big as we can for good media attention or whatever.
Yeah, no, but he said that was conservative. So, but still.
Okay, sure. It's conservative. Great. Well, I would have been thrilled if there was 14 billion. That would have been amazing. So that's a catalyst for sure. But the bigger catalysts, I think, are just the infrastructure pieces and the early use cases. So stablecoin growth, I think, is the biggest. Really, these things, you should think of these things both as on-ramps, right? Both the Bitcoin ETF and both stablecoins are, like, they're kind of like gateway drugs into the broader crypto market, right?
Well, I think stablecoins are, but ETFs are more like, they're just more passive. So I don't know if they're an on-ramp.
I think, like, they're definitely definitionally an on-ramp, but I hear what you're saying in the sense that it's,
like, you don't own those private keys.
That's
you can't,
right.
Like, yeah, once you get that Bitcoin, you can't do anything with it.
And you're not setting up a wallet. Like, it's not, like, incredibly easy for you to then take that asset and move it into DeFi like it is in stablecoins, and I think a lot of people, they buy their first stablecoin on Binance or something, but yeah, often they move it right into DeFi. It's composable. So it's not quite as good an on-ramp, no doubt, but I think it's maybe more like culturally an on-ramp, getting people financially invested, getting people thinking about this sort of thing. And then you start thinking, and you have Bitcoin ETF, then you start thinking, well, maybe I should own my Bitcoin outright, or maybe I should buy some other of these, like, what are these other altcoins doing? So, but yeah, like, there's more room to make better TradFi on-ramps for sure, but it solves a need, right? It solves a need by lowering the barrier to entry into the space, right? So those are the benefits I see to these things, and those are the catalysts. How do we get stablecoins into more people's hands? How do we get, you know, people get their first crypto asset and so forth, and like a reason for them to actually get their first crypto asset? The infrastructure stuff is kind of just stuff we've been talking about. It's like the the somewhat boring stuff that is like the behemoth in the background that actually causes like the earthquakes and causes the tsunamis to actually occur on the front end. And that's like steady pace, really. Like I don't think there was actually any slowdown in infrastructure development at all in the bear market. Like it's possible it's even anti-correlated. Like, I mean, it's very hard to measure. Like, how do you measure like pace of infrastructure development? But it may be slightly negative correlated or at least uncorrelated to the price of Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, I guess. But my question is, if like 2017 was the ICO craze, 2021 was NFTs, then like, what do you think this bull market will be about?
Well, I don't think it has to be something totally new. Like, I think that's a very like tail wags a dog kind of thinking a little bit, where it's like, it's got to be some new flashy narrative. So, you know, there's like Bitcoin L2s and there's gaming and there's lots of narratives that just sort of pop and fall down. And at the end of the day, I think of all technology as like, there's the why now of why people like, and all like startups, protocols, whatever. It's what's the problem it's solving today? How does it make it easier for people to do their existing activities or whatever? So just more like better stable coins that are faster and more secure and more composable and things like that, or that offer yield or whatever, like that alone is like, if you can do that, the TAM is trillions, right? So you can like 1000x the size of the market that way. You don't need to have like some new flashy thing to entertain people for a couple months. The other thing in DeFi is like, it's totally, yeah, I mean, like building more institutional tooling in DeFi is another thing that could bring 100x more users to DeFi. Building more capital efficient systems, the fact that everything's over collateralized, except Terra, that was obviously a bad example of under collateralization. But yeah, if you could create like these sort of synthetic asset experiments that are actually like smart ways to do under collateralization, that then brings that, like the market size of like over collateralized lending versus under collateralized lending is just like, just a hundred, like an order or two orders of magnitude bigger than the others. So what is that? Like capital efficient DeFi? I know that's not the sexiest thing, like capital efficient DeFi or like a few more real world assets or better stable coins. I think that's the big stuff, to be honest, that those are like the lowest hanging fruits that could bring you 10 to 100x more users, in my opinion.
I mean, maybe this is the cycle when finally that phrase like wall of institutional money will actually mean a thing.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. Again, it's like, what is it doing? Is it just going to buy Bitcoin because it's like a new gold? Like that, I mean, yeah, that actually, now that I said it, that sounds great. Like that's doable as well. But what I hope will happen as well will be more, yeah, the infrastructure really improves the 0-to-1 use cases and makes new things possible. So I think DeFi has like 100x room to grow from where it is just by these sort of relatively small fixes. There's other stuff that's interesting, of course, like SocialFi. We've seeded a few things in social crypto. I will just say, as investors, it's. I mean, by the way, like no financial advice, all those caveats. But one reason we like infrastructure is it's kind of an investment in everything built on top, right? And same with DeFi. If you need DeFi protocols and if you need, you know, things like EigenLayer or new blockchains to build your social applications on top of, that's good. It usually accrues some value that way. It is tough though, because it's very hard to predict like what will hit in social, for instance, or when, right? We backed a project called BitClout, or now it's called DeSo in the early days. And it was like a decentralized Twitter. And this was before Elon bought Twitter and changed it. And you know, at the time, Twitter was totally ossified. It had never really shipped new product in years. And it was banning lots of people left and right, all this stuff, right? And they got pretty big for a crypto project. They got like millions of users, and they got a New Yorker article. That's kind of my sort of like East Coast, like whatever middle class upbringing. It's like when you get a New Yorker article about you, like you're in the main, like people are paying attention to you, right? And it was like this very like Black Mirror kind of like, oh, the future of social when everyone has their own coin and stuff. But it didn't take off too much. And now they're building infrastructure mostly. They're mostly like a layer one blockchain that builds infrastructure to support other types of social applications on top. So nothing has hit yet in a big way there. And, you know, Friendtech did the same thing. It was very similar to BitClout. And it kind of went up and down in a very, you know, like a Christmas tree way, going up and then down. So it's hard to predict these things, but I think we understand the pieces of infrastructure that are required to make these things happen, at least.
All right, Alex. Well, this has been a super fun conversation. Where can people learn more about you and Hack VC?
Yeah, hack.vc. We got the domain. So I would just go there and you could probably find my Twitter from there and all that fun stuff.
Perfect. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on Unchained.
Totally. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. To learn more about Alex and Hack VC, check out the show notes for this episode. Unchained is produced by me, Laura Shin, with help from Nelson Wong, Matt Pilchard, Juan Urbanovich, Megan Gavis, Shashank, and Margaret Curia. Thanks for listening. Unchained is now a part of the CoinDesk Podcast Network. For the latest in digital assets, check out Markets Daily, 5 days a week, with host Noel Atchison. Follow the CoinDesk Podcast Network for some of the best shows in crypto.